Welcome to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, Global Market Strategist for JP Morgan Asset Management. Now, normally on this podcast, I'm asking questions to our guests from across the alternative investing industry. But today's episode is a little different. Our team gets a lot of questions every day from clients about investing in alternatives. So we thought we'd look at some of the top questions we've been getting lately. I'm joined today by Grant Papa. Grant is a research analyst on our Market Insights team and someone I work with every day in our Guide to Alternatives. So today, Grant will be the one asking me the questions and I'll be answering them. So Grant, I'll turn it over to you. What are some of the top questions we've been getting from clients?
Thank you, Aaron. And thank you for letting me sit in the host seat today. I really appreciate it. There are no shortage of questions we get on a daily basis about the alternatives industry. So let's jump right into it.
Let's do it.
I think there's no better place to start our conversation today than which asset classes and alternatives are seeing the most inflows and outflows. In your opinion, what are you seeing? What asset classes are seeing the most outflows? And maybe, you know, what you think could you see a turnaround in some of these asset classes?
Yeah, I think so. So when we look at this very closely in terms of which asset classes, and when I say asset classes, I mean everything from private equity to venture capital, hedge funds, and so on, where money is being added and where money is being taken out of these asset classes. So we've got good data when it comes to either institutional or individual investors in this space. I would look at two where I think we may see some changes in the next sort of quarters and maybe years. One is private credit that has had just enormous inflows, particularly from individual investors. Now, I don't think that's necessarily going to reverse, but I do think investors are going to get more selective when it comes to allocating to private credit. So the large part of private credit is made up of direct lending, which is investing in the private equity space, and it's provided very healthy returns for a long period of time. The challenge is when we come into an economy that's potentially more challenging, you've got inflation risks, you've got tariff risks. So it is important for investors to be more selective. And I think we'll see that opening up to areas like secondaries investing in private credit, like distressed investing in private credit, like asset-backed private credit. It's a very wide space, and I think there's a lot more opportunities as folks become as well cognizant of some of the risks within private credit. Another area I think we could see some changes in terms of where money is moving is hedge funds. So hedge funds has been interesting because over the last decade, let's say, for institutional investors, we've actually seen outflows in many parts of the hedge fund space. The reason behind this is it's been a very challenging period for hedge funds. Some of my colleagues in the hedge fund part of our business call it the hedge fund winter, the alpha winter, because the conditions just weren't very good for generating alpha. And when they look at what are those conditions, it's interest rates were low, all stocks were going up. There's not a lot of difference or disparity, and hedge funds are trying to take active bets on winners and losers. And when there's only winners, as we've had for the last 10 years of very healthy returns on stock markets, it's tough for them to really generate alpha. So, and on top of that, you have a lot of institutional investors that are heavily allocated to hedge funds. So they've been looking at maybe other alternative asset classes. Now, I think that's something that's going to change because we're entering into a period that's likely to be very beneficial for hedge funds. And I think that's something that the industry is watching very closely. So you've got some of those factors that I mentioned in terms of the alpha winter. We're heading into maybe an alpha summer where you have higher interest rates. That tends to be good for hedge funds. You have certainly a lot of volatility, and that's where hedge funds tend to make their money. And then a lot of opportunities to make active bets because this is really a time to be actively investing. There's a very wide difference between the winners and the losers on stock exchanges, and hedge funds that are actively making those bets are likely to benefit. So I think we're likely to see some more attention being paid to hedge funds over the coming quarters. And then when it comes to private credit, not necessarily outflows, but I think more selectiveness and looking at areas outside of sort of the direct lending space.
And we show some of this allocation preferences on page 15 of the guide to alternatives by both institutional and private wealth investors.
We do indeed. Yeah.
So turning now to an asset class that you did not mention, but one I'd like to dive a little bit deeper in, is private equity. What is your outlook on the private equity exit environment? Are we really seeing the M&A and IPO conditions improve?
Yeah, so I just came back from holidays in Ireland, so I'm kind of coming out of holiday mode, but I can give you a little analogy when it comes to private equity. So I went to a wedding in farming country in Ireland, right in the middle of Ireland, where there's barley fields. And private equity is a little bit like barley farming, where you're growing a crop, you're investing in companies over a period of time. When the crop's ready, they're selling those companies, realizing the value of the investment. Now, this year, when we came into it, we were actually quite excited this could be a good exit season, right? Or a good harvest season, because to return cash to investors, you have to sell those companies after improving them. And the reasons for that were we have a new administration in the United States, very business friendly, likely to be tax breaks, and inflation was coming back towards 2%. So a lot of stability, and stability is good, or it's maybe a better word than stability, would be positivity around the business environment. And that tends to be a good thing for allowing exits to happen. Now, quarter one started off very good harvest in terms of M&A activity, IPO activity, distributions improved in terms of private equity investors. As we got into Q2, we had a lot of volatility in markets. We had a lot of uncertainty over what the economic situation is going to be with tariffs, with other policy changes. And we saw a slowing down then in exit activity. And I sort of relate this to when you have a storm come through, when you have heavy rains, it's hard to get the tractors in, it's hard to get the trailers in to actually take the harvest, even if it's good harvest. So, what does Q3 and 4 look like? I think that a lot is going to be determined by the decisions made in Washington and getting clarity on some of the policies, some of the economic economic outlook for next year. I kind of go back to when I was starting off as an analyst working on M&A transactions. When a private equity firm is getting ready to sell the business, the first thing the analyst does is opens up Excel and types in the revenue and the profits for the first year of the business. And from there, you build on year two and three, and that's how you value a company. It's very challenging today to value a company because you don't know what the year one revenue is going to be. You don't know what the year one margin is going to be, because what's the impact of tariffs? What's the impact of a potentially slowing economy, increased labor costs, all the other factors that are going into it? So I think we'll need to get clarity on some of that before we see as buoyant an exit environment as we had kind of pre-COVID 2019, even 2021 type season. But I think a lot of the extreme uncertainty that we had maybe in April time of year is become alleviated, and conditions are certainly improving. And we've seen this. We've seen a number of IPOs recently. That's positive. And the narrative coming from companies in terms of M&A activity is certainly improving. So I'm optimistic that the second half of the year, or coming into the early first half of next year, could be a very good one for exit activity.
And I like your analogy on the harvest. That's great. But let me play devil's advocate for a second. What if the exit environment continues to stall and we do not see that improvement? What then?
Yeah, well, if we go back to the harvest analogy, the good thing about private equity investing is the crop doesn't spoil, right? I think this is an important distinction. When we're talking to clients, we often get confused between, if private equity companies aren't exiting, what does that mean for returns? Well, it doesn't really mean anything for returns, because the companies are still held by private equity firms. They're still improving them. There's a lot of levers that private equity firms can pull over time if they're given an extra few years to add extra returns. They can improve operations in the businesses. They can improve marketing and commercial activity and so on. So the businesses are still improving. It doesn't necessarily mean anything in terms of returns, but it is impactful to liquidity. So for investors, particularly in drawdown funds, kind of traditional private equity type funds, that are designed to be limited duration in nature, it's tough for them in terms of liquidity if they're banking on exiting within 7 years or so. I think for investors that are more concerned about liquidity, there are solutions. Looking at as they're making new commitments, when liquidity is a concern, look at the small to mid-market part of the private equity landscape. Smaller companies can transact without necessarily requiring economic conditions to be perfect. There are deals that just make sense in any environment. They can be acquired by strategic acquirers and so on. And there's a lot more activity in the small to mid-cap space within private equity. So that another area I'd look at would be secondaries. And secondaries is a part of the private equity space that's evolved sort of more recently. It's been around for a long time, but it's grown significantly recently. Last year, there was $160 billion of secondaries transactions. And it's likely to exceed that number this year, by the way. And the benefit of secondaries is they allow existing investors to exit before the private equity fund is completed its time frame, and they allow new investors to enter at a discount. So it's providing an opportunity for those existing investors to get liquidity, and then for new investors investing in funds that offer secondaries, they're getting an immediate discount in a very widely diversified fund. So I think that's been a very positive development, and that's alleviated a lot of the concerns that people may have in entering into a private equity investment, because now you have these evergreen funds that have access to secondaries and have access to this sort of other means of getting liquidity. So that's been a very positive development that has kind of, I think, taken away some of the concerns that people have about entering into a private equity investment.
And to your point, we saw in the first half of the year over $100 billion in deal volume in private equity secondary. So it's definitely continuing to grow. Yeah. But I want to go back to a little bit of what you touched on with drawdown funds versus evergreen structures. Can you explain a little bit what the investment philosophy is between the two structures and which type of vehicle might be more appropriate for which type of investor?
Sure. Yeah. You know, and both of them have their place, depending on sort of what investor is looking for and what type of investment. But in the beginning, there was just drawdown funds, right? That's where private equity started. It's kind of, to go back to that harvest analogy, you're planting the seeds, they buying a number of businesses. An investment fund is designed to live for, say, 7 to 10 years. Make its investments during that time frame, and then exit them. Now, there's some challenges with this, and we'd go back to the concept of a J curve, right? So, because there's when you look at the cash flows that are going into and coming out of this investment, it kind of looks like a J type symbol, because for the first year or two of a fund's existence, they're acquiring companies, so the money is not actually being put to work for a period of time, and that's a drag on returns. Similarly, for the last couple of years, as they're realizing those investments, part of that money has not been put to work. So, an interesting development over the last, I think it's only 10, 15 years, really, we've had evergreen fund structures become more accessible to people. And what this has allowed is mitigating that J-curve effect, where investors can be invested from day one into a vehicle that is designed to last sort of for an unlimited duration. Their money's put to work from day one, and then they can exit at a time of their choosing, right, within the bounds of what the fund allows them. It might be quarterly or so on. And, you know, rather than being forced to exit because the fund has completed its life cycle and then they need to go and search for a new investment. So I think for most investors that are new to private equity, an evergreen fund is probably the way to go, because it simplifies a lot of these things. You don't have the J-curve effect. You're investing and exiting really on your own time frame, and you're fully invested from day one, and you're invested in a diversified set of companies really from day one, because you're not waiting for that money to be allocated and going off and buying companies. So for most investors, that tends to be the vehicle of choice these days, particularly private investors. I think another aspect of that is that with evergreen funds, you have diversification by vintage, which is a challenge with drawdown funds, where you need to be investing every year, committing to new funds if you really want to be kind of mitigating the effects of any one particular year having liquidity issues. And so, yeah, it's been a very positive development. I think there's a place for drawdown funds for a very specific type of ventures, maybe investing in a particular geography or a particular opportunity. But you do have these risks of not having liquidity and your money not being invested for the full period.
Now, we get a lot of questions about data centers, particularly with the boom in AI and the interest in AI growing. How should investors approach investing in data centers?
Yeah, there's been a lot of exciting developments coming from AI, whether it's data centers on the public market, and then you got on the private market, a lot of opportunities coming out of it. There's a lot of ways to access this space. So I would place data centers within infrastructure, though it's kind of between real estate and infrastructure. Within infrastructure, I think it's important to distinguish between core and non-core infrastructure and what's right for investors' portfolio. So infrastructure is an excellent investment if investors are looking for low volatility, steady returns, right? So that's core infrastructure, investing in utility companies, water companies, and so on. Non-core infrastructure is on the riskier side, and I'd put data centers within that category, where they're developing assets, they're building something. There may be some more uncertainty around the cash flows and what that's going to look like in future. And both have their place, but it really depends on what an investor is looking for in their portfolio. Are they looking for something that's got some more growth and potentially more risk, which would be data centers? Or are they looking for an investment that is more stable, less volatile, has inflation hedging component to it, which would be that core infrastructure component? And so I think that's sort of the first consideration that investors should take when looking at data centers, is what's the outcome they're looking to achieve from their portfolio. When it comes to risk, I think there's one risk that's overlooked by some investors when it comes to data centers, and that's obsolescence. We can kind of fall into the trap of thinking of a data center as just as a piece of real estate. It's a big building with computers in it, but it's a lot more than that. There's a significant amount of that investment, 30% or more, is technology. And a data center 5 years ago, 10 years ago, is very different from a data center today. And we really don't know what a data center 10 years from now is going to look like, because it's very dependent on what the GPUs and the technology that's going to be required for that. This cooling technology, the water that's circulating through that facility, and so on. So there is a non-zero risk of obsolescence, and that's something that needs to be considered by investors when getting into that category. You know, if looking to play the AI theme in a less volatile way, core infrastructure does allow you to do that, because one of the major impacts from AI and new large language models is they consume an enormous amount of power. And so not only do you need data centers to house that equipment, but you need utility companies and power plants to generate that power. And that would be within that core infrastructure space. And it's in a way for investors to kind of play that theme in a lower volatility way, but still be exposed to some of the benefits that we're seeing from the AI evolution.
And let's wrap up our conversation with real estate. How do you assess the real estate market today? With rate cuts on the horizon, is now an attractive time to enter into real estate in today's environment?
Yeah, well, lower interest rates typically are good for real estate, but I wouldn't make that the only factor. I think it's really important to be selective when it comes to real estate investment and be an active manager of real estate. So, and I wrote a blog on this with Thomas Kennedy, who's the head of research for the real estate business, looking at the kind of the impact of interest rates and so on. It's really not the only factor, though it is a positive, and certainly some of the real estate colleagues are getting a lot more inbound calls as there's more talk of interest rates coming down. But if we go back to what's caused a significant valuation reset within commercial real estate, there was two factors, not just interest rate, but COVID. And so COVID has really changed, of course, how we're working and living and playing. It's impacted the office sector in terms of work from home. It's impacted the residential sector with moves to suburbs. It's impacted hotels and hospitality. That's given rise to a lot of opportunities. And there's many real estate investors and funds that have done really well even during this period of higher interest rates. And I think that's really the key thing that investors should be looking for is the ability to perform during that time, during a more challenging time, as they're likely to be the investors that will outperform when the wind's at their sails and we see interest rates coming down.
Well, that's all the questions we have for today, Aaron. Thank you for sharing your insights with not only me, but for the audience as well.
I appreciate it, Grant. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you very much for listening to the Alternative Realities podcast. You can download our quarterly guide to alternatives at jpmorgan.com/GTA. And if you've not already done so, please subscribe to Alternative Realities on your favorite podcasting platform.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.